This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. Perpetual war between superstates following a global atomic war that has reduced civilization to rudimentary facilities. The perpetual wars between Oceania, Eurasia, and East Asia. The action takes place in 1984 in a place called Airstrip 1 that looks a whole lot like England. The hero, or protagonist, is named Winston Smith, a modest man who lives by himself in an apartment where he's watched perpetually by Big Brother on a television screen. Perpetual surveillance in a perpetual world of war. The heroine, named Julia, rebels. She rebels by seducing older men, such as Winston Smith. There is a plot, but we turn away from 1984 by George Orwell to consider an irony. In Russia now, the conduct of the war in Ukraine is not allowed to be called a war. It's a special military action. Dissent is not permitted. Surveillance state routinely punishes anyone who diverges from the opinion that we're winning this war and we're fighting for an existential war for our existence against the West, a perpetual war. The Cold War never ended. The Second World War might never have ended, according to the vision from Moscow. The twist here is that in a recent exchange in Moscow, there was a comment by a spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry that suggests that George Orwell has many uses. The headline in the Telegraph, Russia claims George Orwell wasn't writing about totalitarianism in 1984. It goes this way. Maria Zakharova, Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman and one of the Kremlin's staunchest propagandists, reports the Telegraph, was quizzed at a public talk by a member of the public who suggested Russia is living in a modern-day replay of Orwell's novel, which depicts a society where natural rights have ceased to exist. Ms. Zakharova refutes. She says, "We thought Orwell was describing totalitarianism. This is a global fake. He wrote about how liberalism would lead humanity into a dead end." Ms. Zakharova went on to say that the audience member should tell her relatives abroad that it's you in the West who live in a fantasy world where a person can be canceled. I welcome Professor H.J. McIndoe, International Relations, to comment on this strange twist where George Orwell's novel, 1984, a dystopian romance, is being used in both warring camps. Professor, a very good evening to you. It's clever.
Good evening.
It's clever, but at the same time, it tells us that we're vulnerable from another point of view to following along in the same crushing of dissent and insisting upon particular language in order to express anything about our present circumstances. Will you comment on Moscow's cleverness, Professor?
This Mrs. Zakharova is, she is tactically clever in trying to make the case that Orwell was really denouncing sort of bourgeois capitalism as it perhaps existed in the United States in the 1950s or the 1960s. But historically, she's completely wrong. First of all, Orwell died in 1950, having been born in 1903. He was for his the strand that you can follow through his life most clearly is his concern with poverty, and of course the England in which he spent some of his time. His mother was French. He was born in India. His mother had been born in Burma. He has a very international career. This was a country where there was great poverty, particularly north of the line of the Trent River, which is sort of north of Birmingham and then, you know, south of Sheffield or whatever. It's he often immersed himself in the life of the poor. So he was a man of the left in the sense that he was sympathetic with socialism. By socialism, he meant pretty much what Clement Attlee meant, which is being sure that everybody in the country has access to food and all the rest. The idea that he was somehow attacking the kind of society that is now exists in Europe, in Japan, in other countries in East Asia, and so forth, it's refuted by his life. Let me just, of course, one of the great books about the lies of communism, and remember that for the whole period of the Soviet Union, there was no freedom of the press, and the kind of surveillance that you talk about was routine. I know from my own firsthand experience and from talking to the woman who was in charge of surveilling me when she later made her way to England. I learned a great deal. It was a surveillance state. It was also a state in which you could not trust anything the media. There was the always saying about the two newspapers, Pravda, which means truth, and Izvestia, which means news, that there's no truth and there's no news in Izvestia and there's no news in Pravda. The Russians were very, very well aware of their predicament. Orwell himself never went to Russia, but he did review the book by Arthur Koestler called Darkness at Noon, which came out in 1941. Koestler was your basic Hungarian Jewish communist whose devotion to Stalin finally broke, and he escaped to England, and he wrote a great book about the inner agonies of somebody during the purge trials in Moscow in the 30s. And here is what Orwell says about the book in a review published. Your book came out in 1940, published in 1941. Orwell says, the book is brilliant, but it is probably most valuable as an interpretation of the Moscow Confessions by someone with an inner knowledge of totalitarian methods. What was frightening about these trials was not the fact that they happened, for obviously such things are necessary in a totalitarian society, but the eagerness of Western intellectuals to justify them. And this was something else that he encountered repeatedly. In other words, the remarkable credulity and self-deception with which Westerners accepted pictures of what was a totalitarian society, namely the Soviet Union in those days, and made apologies for it. And there is certainly an undercurrent. There are people in the West now who look to Putin, of all people, as somehow embodying positive values. This is nonsense, but Orwell was onto this early.
In interpretation of where we are, do you think that Moscow, in this cleverness, you admit that it's clever, do you think Moscow...
I'm astonished that she's even aware of what I always thought of as a kind of failed attempt at literary revisionism that ended abruptly when the Soviet Union ended in 1991. But I remember looking with astonishment at articles that were arguing that Orwell was really pro-communist and anti-Western.
The irony, though, it goes on, because if Vladimir Putin can be admired, as Stalin was admired, as Stalin is still admired in parts of the Russian Federation, if that is possible, then Ms. Zakharova is not speaking entirely in falsehoods, that what we have is a political conversation going on in the West, in NATO, at least since the Second War, in which capitalism is regarded as the problem, and that the failure of Russian socialism was a failure of will, not of ideology. That is a piece of the case that could be made from this Zakharova remark.
Well, I think that what you say is absolutely gets to the heart of the problem, which is that almost as soon as the Cold War began, really with the Berlin airlift and with Stalin's installation of pro-communist governments in the East European states, with the suiciding of the foreign minister of Czechoslovakia, who not only did he throw himself out of a window at the very top of his bathroom, which was very difficult to get to, but he actually closed the window on his way down before he splattered onto the pavement. Those are the things that triggered the Cold War, but not in no time, but by the time we were getting into the 60s, we were getting in the West a revisionist approach, which by the time I became a professor was really taken as the truth, which was that the Cold War was not caused by Russia, nor was our conflict with China caused by China or by their internal systems or their oppression or anything. It was, in fact, caused by failures of American diplomacy. And this became really the Holy Writ. This was the received version. And this is what, for instance, my colleagues of mine teach. The problem is that with the invasion of Ukraine, it seems that that whole approach is repudiated. It's falsified because whoever caused the invasion of Ukraine, it was not the United States. Now, I know there are people who argue that somehow we tempted them in, but the fact is Russia's a very big place. They've got a lot of people. They make their own decisions. They don't wait for a call from some inside the beltway operative. I mean, this is hubristic on the American part to believe this. But I'm seeing now, as the war continues, an attempt to somehow make the situation of Ukraine, which is the victim, make it equivalent to the situation of Putin's regime, which is the aggressor. And of course, this was very much what went on in the period when Orwell was active. Remember, of course, that one of the pivotal moments in his life was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1941, which is what when Russia allied with the Soviet Union and wrong-footed all of the anti-fascists in the West, who then had to change sides and become pro-Soviet, although they lost some of their followers. And you've got a group of dissident socialists in New York who started something called the Partisan Review. And you've got a body of intellectuals who were sort of humanistically inclined to socialism, but who were deeply anti-Stalinist, associated particularly with, as I said, the Partisan Review and various others. And in England, this odd character, Victor Gollancz, who ran something called the Left Book Club. And he wrote a book he published a book called The Betrayal of the Revolution, or The Betrayal of the Intellectuals. And this is very, very relevant, because everything that Orwell wrote during this period is clearly reflects the fact that he had come to see that Soviet communism was the great threat. If I may just add, Orwell, of course, was only in his 30s. He was 33 when the Spanish Civil War began. He volunteered to go to Barcelona, and he tried to fight on the anti-Franco side. But his experience was that he was thrown together with a group of leftists, one party of which was the communists. He couldn't see what they disagreed about, matters of sort of communist theology. And he writes that really the scales fell from his eyes when he found them refusing to let him join the communist forces at that time. And he talks about Barcelona at that time. And he says, no one who lived there then can forget the horrible atmosphere produced by fear, suspicion, hatred, censored newspapers, crammed jails, enormous food queues, and prowling gangs of armed men. And, of course, he was a writer, and his writing is consistently denounces that whole system. So I think that we have the authority of his own life to refute what Mrs. Zakharova says, although I'm not sure that many of our... I think that she's going to get some traction because the war has gone on long enough. We want to get out. We want to blame somebody for it. So if we can't blame Putin, let's blame Zelensky. That's the next step. And it is a clearly ideological war. And it's obvious that Ukraine was a democratic country, albeit an imperfectly democratic country, whereas Putin has long been quite clear to anybody who had any sense of what he was like, a dictator who lied and censored and put out propaganda, put out information that was simply untrue. And his foreign ministry's spokesperson is, she's doing the same thing. And she's clever, but she's absolutely dead wrong. Some of the Western listeners, though, are probably going to say, well, maybe she's got a point.
Professor H.J. Macunder, International Relations, we look forward to the day when Moscow and Washington will both love Big Brother. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.